Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's hard not to wince when you drive up to the gas station these days, to think, no matter the size of your car, that it's just too big, that your house is too far from work, that your budget has no more room to stretch, and to know that gas prices will almost certainly keep on going up. This hour, On Point, how Americans are coping with high gasoline prices. You can join the conversation. Are you feeling squeezed at the pump? Are you driving less? Cutting back elsewhere? Joining me from New York is Justin Lehart, economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He's been closely tracking the recent surge in gas prices and how it's affecting American consumers. Justin, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me on, Jane.
And from Ann Arbor, Michigan, Lutz Killian, professor of economics at the University of Michigan. He has looked closely at the effects of oil price shocks on the economy. Nice to have you, Professor.
Thank you for having me, Alan.
Let me start with you, Justin. What is the real economic impact on families right now of all this?
Well, I think probably the biggest impact is just the money that's going into the gas tank isn't being used for other things. So, I mean, sometimes people talk about it as though it was a tax. And in this sense, that's true. People, you know, money that might have gone toward a vacation or something else is you know, basically getting taken out at the pump.
How quickly can people really change their lifestyles? I mean, based on your reporting, what have you seen? Does it mean, you know, giving up that supersized SUV, the big house in the suburbs, you know, immediately? Or do those things come with time?
The effects, people change their lifestyle immediately, but they can only do so much in the very near term. So you see, you know, right away, we've already seen that that people are cutting back on driving, and that's a very sort of fast effect. But there's, you know, that's sort of a little thing that you can do. You can turn down your air conditioner. You can maybe cut back on trips to the mall. But you can't really help the fact that you have maybe a large house, that your house is far away from any public transportation, that you have a car that maybe you just bought a couple of years ago that uses more gasoline than you'd like. So those adjustments will take a little bit longer.
You talked about people cutting back on driving. What are the numbers? What are you seeing?
Well, we saw that. We only have traffic volume trends through April, but we've seen that the number of miles that people are driving on U.S. roads has fallen, and that's something that really hasn't happened in a long, long time. To the extent that it has this time, it's really the biggest shift that we've seen in driving patterns probably since the 1979 oil shock. Mm.
Professor Killian, a good time to turn to you. Historically, how have Americans responded to past oil crises?
Yeah, so from a consumer point of view, there have been a couple of channels. The first one, of course, is that as you spent more on gasoline, you would think that there would be less money left to spend on other goods and services. So demand for goods and services in the economy would decline. And that's true to some extent, but there are also, of course, some countervailing forces. One example is that to the extent that you're successfully reducing your driving, you're actually spending less on gasoline, and so this effect will be somewhat mitigated. The other effect we tend to forget is that the money that goes abroad, let's say, in response to higher oil prices, isn't necessarily completely gone. It may come back to the U.S. economy to the extent that countries like Saudi Arabia start investing in the U.S. economy or simply purchase goods and services. Hmm. So the overall effect of the reduction in discretionary income might not be quite as bad as it seems.
So some of that filters back. Nationally, what percentage of Americans' budgets are spent on gasoline?
Well, if you combine not just gasoline, but also heating oil, natural gas, and all other forms of energy, in the most recent period, you would have a share of about 6.5%. If you look at longer run averages, then in the 1970s and early 1980s, on average, the share might be around 8%. Since the late 1980s, the average share might be closer to 6%, although it has gone up very recently.
So I've seen different statistics on that. How do you determine that figure?
By simply looking at personal consumption expenditures and dividing up expenditures into the component that goes to all forms of energy, electricity, natural gas, heating oil, and gasoline, and comparing that to expenditures on other goods and services.
So is 6.5%, that's the percentage Americans are spending on gasoline, is the consumer response then, I wonder, in proportion to that number? Is the consumer response in proportion to that number?
The consumer response you can attribute to this effect, the reduction in discretionary income, actually is quite small, as you might have guessed from simply looking at this expenditure share. In other words, it takes a very big increase in energy prices to make this channel important. But this is not the only channel. In fact, another channel people have worried about a lot is the fact that very often when you're buying a durable good, such as a car, that durable good also requires energy to run. So in other words, you need gasoline in order to run a car. And so it's not only that there is an effect on the consumption of gasoline, there also may be an effect on the demand of cars for cars. Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that your expenditure share on cars is a lot larger than just on gasoline, you could have a multiplier effect.
Mm-hmm. Justin Lehart, what about commutes? What about cars, people using their cars? Is life on the edge of suburbia starting to look a bit untenable for a lot of folks?
I think people are concerned about it, for sure. Again, these adjustments take time. You've laid out a huge amount of cash for your house, for your lifestyle. I mean, you have other things that are important for you. You know, other sort of investments in your life that are important for you. So the idea of somehow, you know, picking up stakes and getting closer to the city or something like that. That's a very, very long adjustment. I think, you know, for now people just have to kind of, you know, sit and, you know, put gas into their car and curse at the prices.
So with oil at $143 a barrel just today, so much of the American economy being affected by this. Huge cutbacks now in the airline industry. I mean, just go down the list. I'm looking at statistics here. American carriers reducing flights this year by almost 10%, deeper cuts in store for 2009. The auto industry is facing huge cutbacks. Which other industries will follow, Justin Lehart?
Well, we've, so much of the U.S. economy is based on getting goods very quickly from one place to the other. I spent some time talking to some people last week. If you think about just the whole eBay economy, so many people have started businesses, online businesses, and you know if they're shipping something that's large, then those shipping costs are going to affect them. I talked to people who import flowers. Flowers in this country generally come from Ecuador and Colombia, and there's this. You know, this whole sort of logistics situation where they move these things so quickly, flying them into Miami, speeding them up to the coast to flower shops, and they're definitely feeling it. I talked to a guy who runs a sushi shop in Denver, and you think about that, bringing fish into a landlocked area, and he flies fish all the way from Japan, and of course he's seen you know, his prices go up. So it really touches everyone.
Hmm. Professor Killian, you know, we talk about being shell-shocked by gasoline prices, but I'm looking at a graph here in the New York Times which shows we're actually getting a bargain, if you look at it relatively speaking, in Europe, $7 to $8 a gallon, in Belgium and in the Netherlands, you know, $9 to $10 a gallon. Is there a lesson here for us in this country? What can we learn from the Europeans? They've been through this.
The key difference in gas prices in Europe is that you have a very large component of taxes. Mm. And so that's why the level of gas prices is a lot higher. Now, of course, from the point of view of an economy that's used to a certain level of gas prices, what you have to worry about is any quick change in gas prices, because that will force everybody to adjust. And if you force people to adjust too quickly, that's going to be very costly. And so it's not a question of saying, well, Europeans have been doing just fine with a gas price of $8, let's say, or $9. It's a question of how quickly you can go there.
And so taking all of these things into perspective, Justin Lehart, how does inflation play into all this? As oil prices go up, as all the other prices follow suit, how big of a concern is inflation moving forward?
Well, inflation definitely is a huge concern of the Federal Reserve right now. And we are seeing, through the effects of the weaker dollar and through the effects of rising energy prices and rising food prices, that we're seeing some pass-through into other prices. So that's a huge concern. Now, there are some differences between now and the 70s, and one of them is that people's wage expectations, they don't expect their wages to come up a lot in response to higher inflation. And that was something that was really in place during the 70s. So if people's wages, if there's not sort of a wage mechanism for inflation to really get going, then it's not quite as big a concern.
Well, are wages keeping up with prices now?
No.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking today about high gas prices and what you're doing to mitigate the pain. My guests today, Justin Lehart, economics reporter at The Wall Street Journal, and Lutz Killian, professor of economics at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. I want to go to the phones first because a lot of folks are interested in joining this conversation to share their stories. Lee is first in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Lee. Welcome.
Hi.
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love this show. I just wanted to share some of the things that I've been doing because I'm horrified. I don't have a business that is dependent on oil or gas, thank goodness. But my lifestyle, I have shelved my SUV.
Hmm.
I'm going to turn it into a chicken coop, I think. Nobody's going to want it.
Yeah.
And I drive an old Saab, which gets about 30 miles to the gallon, and I follow a lot of the legal hypermiling tips. So I drive between 60 and 65 miles an hour in overdrive. And it is amazing to me when I'm driving on the highway that some of these mammoth SUVs are flying by me at 80, 85, 90 miles an hour. I just wonder if they haven't got a clue yet.
And so this is trickling down into the very basics of your everyday life, Lee?
Well, even more than basics. Now, I admit this is going to sound a little bit like whining, but I have a second house in Vermont I've owned for almost 20 years, and my passion is skiing and riding horses. I'm not going to be able to do either of them. My house cost me $5,000 to heat last year. This year it's likely going to be $10,000. Mm. The hay I buy for my horses has gone from $3.25 a bale to $6 a bale, and it's just, I don't think I can afford to drive up there anymore.
Hmm.
So I'm probably going to shut the house down because I can't sell it in the market, just drain the pipes, turn it off.
Are you optimistic about the future? Are you looking forward to better times, or you think this is going to stick with us for a while here?
I think this is going to be with us forever. I think we're at the mercy of the Middle East. You know, I don't believe that these are the big oil companies. I think these are the speculators in the Middle East.
Lee, thanks so much. Justin Lehart, you want to respond to that caller? Are we at the mercy of the Middle East in this case?
I think we're probably at the mercy of the laws of supply and demand. And it's really hard to get a read on supply right now because the oil-producing countries don't always give us the best information. But, we have a situation where demand, especially from countries like China and India, is gone up so much in recent years, and just the way that prices work in these markets, supply can't immediately come online. So when you have a shift in demand, you can have much, much higher prices.
Lutz Killian, what's your response to the caller? You hear what she's doing in her everyday life, how it's affecting her. I mean, historically, these things, what's the shift? Does she have something to look forward to, optimism per se?
It's very difficult to forecast oil prices. And in fact, most people who claim to be able to do that may succeed for a while, but then these forecasts tend to break apart. So what we can say, however, is we can understand why oil prices have been moving, and so from there you can conjecture as to where they might be going. So one thing we know is that the increase in oil prices, which also is reflected in increased gas prices since about 2002, was primarily driven by strong global demand, in particular from countries in emerging Asia. And so it's not a question of the Middle East having cut back oil supplies and thereby having engineered an increase in oil prices. It's really the demand in the world, including demand in the United States, of course, that has been driving up prices because supply has been fairly steady. Mm-hmm. And so for that to change, it would be necessary for supply to increase a lot. And, of course, we don't know yet whether this is going to happen and at what rate it is going to happen. But we do know, looking at the past, that we're talking about a horizon of perhaps 5 years to see substantial increases in oil supply. And until then, it's really demand that's going to determine the price of oil.
Hold on just a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining me now from New York City is Paolo Timoni. He's CEO of Piaggio USA, which manufactures the Vespa scooters. Piaggio sold a record 2,758 Vespas in May. That's a jump of 106% since last year. Nice to have you, Paolo. Thanks for being with us.
Hello. Hi, Jane.
So tell me about your record sales. What are consumers, what are customers saying to you when they come in to buy a Vespa?
They say that they are fed up with the gas prices. They want to find a cheaper transportation vehicles, and this is why they start considering motor scooters.
So we see these Vespas around here where we are. Give us the Vespa stats. Why are they so popular? How many miles per gallon and such?
Usually miles per gallon goes between 78 miles per gallon, depending on the driving style. So they're very efficient, and, you know, refilling one of those, it's anything between $5 to $8.
And the cost of a Vespa?
It goes from $2,000 to $6,000.
Mm-hmm. So what's your business potential here as you see it? You see the economic outlook out there. What do you see for your own personal business?
Well, I'm sure that everybody that has been traveling to Europe is very familiar with the situation when you go to London, Madrid, Paris, Milan, Rome, where a lot of people are driving motor scooters to commute to work. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there is something like 30 million people driving around on motor scooters across Europe. Here in the United States, as of today, we have about probably a million people driving motor scooters. And, you know, with the situation getting more and more similar to the situation in Europe, mm-hmm. with high gas prices and terrible traffic congestions, I think that this gap is going to close.
What are the demographics of your customer base, Paolo? Are these young people?
It's very wide. We have customers usually from the mid-20s to the high early 70s because, you know, transportation touches everybody. Everybody needs to move around, and everybody is looking for a possibility to save some money.
Mm. Well, I'm still trying to figure out how to get two car seats on a Vespa, but I'm sure you'll think of something, huh?
Yeah.
Paolo Timoni, CEO of Piaggio USA, spoke with me from New York. I think I appreciate your time today, Paolo. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Back to the phones now. I hear from more of our callers. Brad is in Deering, New Hampshire. Brad, welcome to you.
Hi, everyone.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to set the stage a little bit for my situation here. About 6 years ago, I was working for a high-tech corporation, pretty well paid, worked from my home office, so I telecommuted. Can't get a better commute than that.
Mm-hmm.
But after the tech bubble burst, September 11th and all of that, I got laid off. I had to find a new job. It took me over a year. I found a job that was ostensibly supposed to be my dream job. It ended up being south of Boston, so there was quite a bit of a commute there. And it was significantly less money. But mm-hmm. I thought, you know, this is something I really want to do. I went for it. It turned out that it was, even then, it was very challenging. I had to make a big decision because I couldn't afford where we live. We sold my house. We were hoping to move closer, but when you look at the cost of real estate, the only thing we could afford was to actually move further away from the Boston area. So I ended up in Deering, New Hampshire. So what I have now is a commute that is 99 miles each way.
Hmm.
And so I drive 200 miles a day, 4 hours on the road. Initially, it was the time. I was like, wow, 4 hours. But, you know, now it's the prices. It's literally killing me. And I have no choice. Either I give up this job that I worked so hard to get, took me a year to get, and it's kind of my dream job.
Mm-hmm. But now you feel trapped. I hear what you're saying, Brad, and I really appreciate your call. Justin Lehart, respond to that. I know in your reporting you've heard a lot of this, people trying to make their lives better, and in fact it just gets worse.
Yeah, it's really – it's so hard. And, you know, it's we just don't have the infrastructure in place yet. We may – if high prices persist for a while, we may get the kind of – you know, infrastructure that can you know, ease the pain for people with long commutes. You know, we may get, you know, more mass transportation and so on. But it takes time for that to happen. I think, you know, even when you think about, you know, people buying Vespas, it's going to take time for something like that to really
to really
take off. Well, just think. I mean, I'm in New York City. The idea of driving a Vespa around here is, you know, it's kind of romantic, but it's also kind of terrifying. So, you know, I think that, you know, maybe eventually you have enough of them and then you feel a little bit better about doing something like that.
I wanted to go back to the statistic that I read earlier about Dow Chemical just raised prices 20% on top of another 25% hike because of energy and raw materials costs. So consumers are really feeling the pinch from every direction, aren't they, Professor Killian?
Yes. So there are different ways to think about the impact of higher energy prices. One line of thought says, well, if energy prices and other industrial commodities prices go up, that means that the cost of producing goods and services has gone up. And so that's going to prompt firms to raise their prices. And, of course, that's one way in which consumers feel that pinch. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's not clear that is necessarily the primary channel, because if that were true on a large scale, you would expect those industries that are very energy intensive in production to suffer the most in response to oil price shocks. And historically, there is not a lot of evidence to support that, with very few exceptions.
So everyone focused on the price of oil and gas, but you're saying industrial commodities are going up, the price of copper per se, but nobody's focused on that because everybody, you know, prices don't go up when people don't cut back when spending, when copper prices rise, for example.
Well, the difference is that the price of gasoline is a price that you can observe every day. You drive by a gas station, you see what the price is.
Yes.
Now, that doesn't mean copper isn't important, but of course, copper is embodied in many goods and services you buy, and so you don't actually see the copper price because it's not something you consume yourself. It's only indirectly included in the goods and services you buy.
Marcy's on the line now from Iowa. Marcy, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually live in Iowa, and as you know, we've had these big, massive floods, and you know, we have to still reroute our driving, which has been a mess, but it's okay. You know, we're dealing with it. But I have to say, I heard you mention earlier that, you know, compared to the prices of gasoline in Europe, we're getting a bargain. And I have to say that irritates me to no end when people say that, because our economy structure is so different than it is in Europe. And even my best friend lives in Imperial Beach, California. They found a bargain house for $486,000. Mm-hmm. And it's three bedroom, you know, basic house, nothing fancy. Mm-hmm. We're going to build a three bedroom house here in Mechanicsville, Iowa, in rural Iowa, for $163,000.
Right.
And the price difference within the United States is so vast. And so when you compare, I mean, our gas, yes, it's cheaper here in the Midwest because we have ethanol, you know, we get subsidies for ethanol, blah, blah, blah. And it's $3.87 a gallon. Whereas out there, I think, I don't know what, it's over $4 a gallon where she's at. But if you look at the percentage in comparison...
No, I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. The difference in salaries, the difference in home prices. Justin Lehart, can you respond to that? And do we have an economic structure that's so different in Europe than from Europe?
Yeah, and some of it is just it's just geographical. I mean, we have long distances to travel. And you know, also, you know, Europe has spent a long time creating infrastructure for commuters, and having high gasoline taxes has helped Europe a lot for that, being able to, you know, have mass transportation and so on. You know, on the other hand, you know, Europe to some extent subsidizes trucking, and they're having a horrible time now with high diesel prices because they move so much of their freight by trucks. Hmm. Actually, you know, this is a case where the United States is, you know, arguably more efficient, because more of our freight, you know, something like half of our freight moves by rail, and in Europe it's a much smaller percentage. Hmm.
Back to the phones now. Alicia is in Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Alicia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
Sure.
I am part of a group nationwide and within the city of Newton called Safe Routes to School, and we are trying to turn around that number of, it's now 13% or less of kids who walk to school as compared to 50%, I think, that were in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm really hoping that this higher price of gas, what we'll get more kids to walk to school.
Hmm.
And we have recently won a grant through an organization called Walk Boston to hire a coordinator to help develop programs at all the elementary schools to get more kids to walk.
Hmm.
We are definitely a town, for people who aren't familiar with Newton, where almost every kid gets shuttled to school,
hmm,
singly, by themselves, dropped off at the door, picked up at the door. And, you know, maybe the higher gas prices will, you know, be more effective than the global warming message of, you know, kids can walk. 85% of our kids live within walking distance, and probably only 10 or 15% of them actually walk to school.
Mm. Alicia,
and that's our hope.
Yeah.
So.
I appreciate your call, Alicia. Thank you. We're going to go to a break here, but I wonder, Justin Lehart, Alicia brings up the environment here as part of this. Do people think about the environment as they're responding to this, or is it just a matter of tightening the belt because of economics?
I think that people do think about the environment, and I think that it makes it easier. You know, you always want to. You know, everybody, you know, cares about the environment. It's a lot easier to care about the environment if it also saves you some money. So you can go out and buy a hybrid, and you know, you're saving. You know, you can feel good about cutting back on emissions, and you can also feel really good about not paying as much money for the gas pump.
I have about a minute left. Justin Lehart, I just wanted to ask you, I was reading, there are actually a lot of stories about automobile clubs and towing services that are taking a lot of calls from motorists who are simply just stranded on the side of the road. Folks are just going day to day with the gas that they need, too expensive to buy a whole tank.
Yeah, and that's you know, we tend to kind of want to stretch things out. So I guess that's, you know, that's not a great response. It's interesting too that that people are doing that rather than the you know, the other response is to just constantly top off the tank, and that's something that we saw a lot in the 70s oil crisis.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about high gas prices and how they are affecting you and your family. Joining me this hour is Justin Lehart, economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Lutz Killian, professor of economics at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Straight to the phones now in Jupiter, Florida. Jim is on the line. Jim, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment that there isn't enough discussion about how the built environment is plays into our decisions as Americans, you know, how long to be commuting or whether even to have a vehicle, whereas in many other countries you can have the choice of living in a place where you can work or where you can use a trolley or just commute a very short distance. Here the built environment is such that you've got pods of places where people live, you got places where people work, you got places where people go to school, and they're all connected only by roads that force you to use vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And so the smart discussion may be to use a smaller vehicle instead of a larger vehicle, or if you have a small vehicle, to use a Vespa instead of a small vehicle. But there is no discussion whatsoever about building places such that you can live, work, play all within a 15 or 20 minute walking distance.
I hear your point, Jim, and it's a really good one. The infrastructure in our country, not really set up for this. And I hear it anecdotally all the time, actually, Justin Lehart, Professor Killian, the bus route or the subway stop is nowhere near my house. You know, I can't make that happen. Are you hearing that in your reporting, Justin?
Certainly we hear that. And there's also, you know, more talk about people moving closer to the train station. I think to the extent that builders are, you know, thinking about building houses at all these days, they're thinking about people's commutes. But also, you know, you do see some communities have over the past several years developed more of a sort of a commuting infrastructure. Professor Killian comes from one of them, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Years ago, you know, not many people would take the bus there. Now, mass transit is something that a lot of Ann Arborites use.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible.
Professor Killian, how must American infrastructure change to accommodate our new way of life?
You know, you would expect that over time, people would change where they live. You might see companies deciding to move closer to where people live. So it's just a question of relative prices working out and it taking a lot of time.
I guess in Europe, transportation costs have been so high for so long that they've already taken into account transportation when buying a home. I mean, there are lots of things that they've already done that we're just on the cusp of, I guess.
Right. That's what I mentioned earlier. It's not so much the difference in the level of gas prices that matters. It's how you get there. And in Europe, they've been having high and rising gas prices for a long time, and so the economy gradually has adjusted. So homes have become much better insulated. People have found other ways of economizing on the use of energy, and we're still far behind in the United States.
Let me bring in another voice now. Joining me from Waterford, Michigan, is County Executive L. Brooks Patterson. The largest county in Michigan is where he is, 1.2 million people. The area is north of Detroit. On June 12th of this year, the county approved a plan to give its workers 4,000 employees, actually, in all, the option to work 4 10-hour days every week. Nice to have you, Mr. Patterson. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much. How are you, Jane?
So tell us about your plan. How'd you come up with it?
Well, obviously, the issue of rising gas prices is troubling for all of us, including my employees. And we were sitting around talking about what we could do, not so much for the county itself, but for our employees. And the 4-day work week, now that'll be staggered, so we'll have two shifts. One will work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. The other group works Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. So we're open 5 days for 10 hours. And when we started doing the numbers, just started noodling those around, if we took just 1,600 of my 4,000 employees and they save 20% of their commute, and I'll be very, very conservative, let's say they save a gallon going to work and a gallon going home, so 2 gallons at $4,
mm-hmm.
I'm 1,600, we're talking, you know, it's about $600,000. But if you take it out to 100,000 workers, which is really easy for us to achieve, we have 760,000 jobs in Oakland County, or the Tri-County area, if you will. So then let's say 100,000 with the same math, saving 2 gallons on that last day they don't work, that fifth day, at $4 a gallon, we're talking $42 million.
Mm.
So if we're talking some real money that goes in the pockets of the employees who they can use that money for, let's say, their rising food costs.
So I can't imagine they're anything but ecstatic about this. What are they telling you?
They're standing in line. Now, not all 4,000 jobs are amenable to a 410, and it has to be voluntary, so if they want it. And then we do have some union issues we have to negotiate. But I think if the membership of the union wants it, the union would be hard-pressed not to go along. So we're already migrating employees into that 410, and we have about 100, 150 right now.
Mm.
And it'll be a gradual transition. But I'm looking forward to getting a third of my workforce into that 4-day week.
Gradual transition, and it is voluntary. I wonder if there are any downsides to your mind to this 4-day work week.
Yeah, I've been trying to be honest about it, Jane. I'm trying to think what it would be. The morale is up. And when morale goes up, productivity goes up. From the public's point of view, it doesn't cost them a dime more, and yet they get an extended work day for county service. Instead of 8 hours, it's 10 hours. Everybody enjoys that fifth day off. It gives you a 3-day weekend. So, I just see it as a win-win, and you know, God only knows how high the gas prices are going to continue to spiral, but they're still going up even as we speak, so I think we're going to get more and more.
Well, tickets. I wonder, it's not just an issue of rising gas prices, is it? I mean, obviously that's the core of this, but your employees are assuming more of their health care costs, and I would assume in this economy your city revenue is slowing. I mean, there are a lot of factors here that played into this.
Last year we had no raises. This year we have a modest 1%, but we took that 1% away with higher co-pays. So these are tough times in and out of government. The private sector is struggling. We in government are struggling. And here in Michigan, in Oakland County, 62% of my budget is based on property taxes. And we're in a precipitous decline here in this state because we are tied so closely to the automotive industry. So this is a perfect storm that we're struggling with.
You're encouraging local businesses, Mr. Patterson, to follow your lead. What are they saying?
Well, they're coming along. We have IBM just sent me a letter. We have other major corporations that are, you know, doing their due diligence. A couple of small companies have come on board, and we're keeping a running total as they commit. And I really do believe, Jane, we're going to get to the 100,000 people who are working in the four-day week. And then I did the math with you. That's $42 million in their pocket.
Hmm. And what about schools? I mean, how far might you take this?
Well, again, it's all voluntary. The schools would be a little hard-pressed, although one of the townships in my county, I have 61 communities, and one of the townships went to a flat four-day work week. So they're going to work 4-10s and not open on Friday. Mm. And I don't know how that's going to work out. I have a little issue with that because if you can only get to the township for business on Friday and it's closed, it's going to be an interesting. But anyway, they're all looking at different variations, but everybody wants to save money for their employees.
Save money. Everything's on the table. Brooks Patterson, executive of Oakland County, speaks with me from Waterford, Michigan. I appreciate your time, Mr. Patterson. Thank you.
Not at all. I look forward to it again. Thanks, Jane.
Thank you, sir. Back to the lines now. Laurel is in Tynemouth, Vermont. Hi, Laurel. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my talk about the environment, because I think that's hugely where this is coming from. That here I'm standing in my yard right now, and I have such.
You know, I'm sorry we're losing you on the line here. I see from my notes on the screen that you live in a rural community, 17 miles from work. You've got 12 miles from your kid's school. You have a car that has 21 miles per the gallon. So she's trying not to drive. She's trying to make other things work for her and her family. Here's another call, another voice, another situation. Carl, who's in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Carl. Welcome.
Hi there. During the 70s, the government cut the speed limit back down to 50 miles an hour. They haven't done that yet. Is that the economists haven't discovered that they haven't determined that the cost-time-benefit ratio hasn't been reached yet? Or is it that nobody in government really wants to do that or they care anymore?
Mm. Carl, thanks. Good question. Professor Killian, you want to take a stab?
Yeah, I think the margin of adjustment that you get from switching to a more energy-efficient vehicle is probably going to be much more important than imposing a speed limit. I mean, if you're driving a gas guzzler, it's still going to be a gas guzzler, even if you're going 55 miles per hour. And so I think the solution is not going to be the speed limit, but allowing people to switch to more energy-efficient cars over time.
Professor Killian, is oil or the oil prices that we're seeing, is this the trigger that sends us into a recession if we're not already in one?
I think you have to be very careful. There's a temptation to think of what would happen if we somehow could control and change oil prices and make them lower than they are. But actually, oil prices reflect a lot of movements in the economy, and you really can't think of them in isolation. For example, right now, the reason oil prices are high is strong global demand. But strong global demand also has good effects, positive effects on the U.S. economy. And so they all come in a parcel. So, for example, you might be able to buy inexpensive goods coming in from China, and that is the arrival of these goods occurs for the same reasons that are driving up oil prices. And so if you were to lower oil prices, you also would have to take away that stimulus from the economy.
Hmm. Back to the lines now. Morgan in Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Morgan. Welcome.
Hello there.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling. I have so many things I could say. One is shame on America for not seeing this one coming. It's like we turned our blind eyes to the mortgage crisis, which we all, anybody informed, even politicians, turned a blind eye to it. We saw it coming years before it became frontline, you know, news. As for this crisis in gas prices, how much is related to the fact that the American dollar is just doesn't have the same value as it used to? We're buying oil with American dollars. The dollar the dollar is depreciating, and hopefully they won't change, you know, how we buy oil. The dollar will continue to be the, you know, the currency that oil is purchased at. But what effect does that have on our oil prices here at home? Because people in Europe aren't whining as loudly as we are.
Morgan, and thank you. Let's ask Professor Killian. I appreciate your call. Thanks. The weak dollar, how much does this play into it?
Yes, the weak dollar doesn't directly affect the price you pay for oil because the price of oil is already denominated in dollars. The difference it makes comes from people abroad purchasing oil in their currencies because they actually benefit from the depreciation of the dollar. And so overall, the demand for oil in the world goes up relative to what it would have been otherwise. And so there's been a lot of talk lately that this was one of the prime movers of higher oil prices. That's actually a little bit hard to tell because if you look historically at the effects of changes in the price of the dollar on demand for oil, there doesn't appear to be at least a very strong relationship. Mm-hmm. So I think the importance of the depreciating dollar is overemphasized.
Mm. Interesting. Casey is on the line now from Marion, Iowa. Casey, welcome.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead. You're on the line.
I just wanted to call in state my story, and that I lived in San Diego, and I commuted there 2 hours one way, and the gas prices were obviously pretty horrible, and getting a 1,500 square foot home was close to $1 million. So, a lot of friends that I knew that graduated college out there in that situation had to move out, and one of the things I did was I actually moved my family at 7, and we moved out to Marion, Iowa. And now, basically, it takes about a 10-minute commute. Hmm. And compared to what was going on previously, and now gas prices are even soaring further. Some people out there today are asking themselves, you know, what can I do to avoid a commute or to change things? And maybe one of the things you have to change is where you're living, because of the home prices compared to the good jobs that are out there.
2-hour commute compared to a 10-minute commute, it's kind of a no-brainer. Casey, thanks for your call and your story. David is in Cohasset, Massachusetts. Hi, David. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm on the road here. I'm calling because I'm angry, and I'm angry because of all the carping and complaining about our dire straits. As a previous caller said, we should have seen this coming. The first was in 1970. And what have we done since then? We've got NASCAR, which consumes just phenomenal amounts of fuel. Our recreational use of fuel for jet skis and motorboats, cigarette boats, second homes that are 100, 200 miles away. I mean, we've just been callously indifferent to the forecast that this was coming. And had we done what the Europeans had done, we would not be in this predicament. The time is now to roll up our sleeves, stop complaining, and get it done. That's
David, thank you. Recreational gas consumption's got to go. Justin Lehart, comment?
Well, you know, one thing that happened after the 1970s is the U.S. really did have a very strong response, and the U.S. became much more energy efficient. And then what happened was, oil prices fell quite a lot. And, over time, that was sort of an incentive that led a lot of people to increase their energy use. Not too long ago, I think it was Car and Driver or Motor Trends did a comparison of sort of the cars, the typical, kind of Toyota Camry car to the sports cars that they were looking at 20 years earlier. And they found that, 0 to 60 on sort of the stuff that, we drive around now was faster than these sports cars from 20 years ago. So basically the message there is that, all of the kind of development that happened in the vehicle sector was aimed at, more power rather than development that might have been aimed at, better fuel economy.
Professor Killian, I'll give you the last word. I have about 30 seconds. I've heard a couple of callers say, shame on us. We should have seen this coming. Could we have seen this coming in our country?
I think given the track record of forecasts of oil prices, the answer is probably no. So it's really a question of whether you want to prepare for that possibility. And those of us who remember the late 1970s and early 1980s probably would have been more reluctant to buy an SUV than newcomers to the market. But nobody knew that this was going to happen for sure in advance.
Interesting conversation, fascinating insights from you both. I appreciate your time today. Lutz Killian, economics professor at the University of Michigan. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Justin Lehart, economics reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Justin, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.